This episode of AVXL is brought to you by our awesome crew of Patreon supporters. Our listeners make the show possible. Learn more at patreon.com/AVXL. This episode of AVXL was recorded on January 12th, 2017, and we're going to talk, well, about CES 2017. New TVs, the complete collapse of 3D, the rise of more HDR specs, speakers, amps, headphones, and, oh yeah, the joys of installing a projector. All that and so much more in this episode of AVXL.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
And boy, did we see all the budgets at CES this year.
Without a doubt. Something for everyone.
Oh my goodness.
I don't care how fat the checkbook is or the wallet or how skinny.
Yeah.
There was something there for you.
Oh my goodness.
Holy cow.
We can spend all your money if you want. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Pretty TVs, the best 4K projector we've ever seen, some righteous speakers. And you know what? I don't think anybody died this week, so we don't have to have the moment of sadness somewhere in the middle of the show.
I see lots of post-CES plague running around.
Yeah.
I had thought I had an itchy throat for like a day, but I'm telling you, flu
did
shots,
you lick any
people.
Doorknobs this year?
No.
See?
I did the flu
no
shot,
No doorknob
though.
Licking, no plague.
I try.
This is practically science.
I didn't wash my hands for days on end, though.
I washed my hands every chance I got.
No, but I think maybe it's a little bit of just positive thinking, but the flu shot I think is really defending me this year.
Positive thinking, denial. It's all a thin line, man. I think the flu shot was probably a very good idea.
I will say this is probably one of the best years where I've dealt with the crowds at CES in terms of just kind of realizing how it all sort of works at this point after doing it for almost 20 years now. I think I've mastered the ability to get around with an extra couple hundred thousand people in town.
I was good till I tried to get into a meeting at like 8 a.m. at the Venetian, which is where so many of the companies had suites there, and of course all the audio companies were upstairs there. That
effectively like the
me.
Top 5 floors of the building, and you can start at the top and walk your way down. And
plus all the stuff downstairs, all the ballrooms and stuff. It was the last quarter mile there took me 45 minutes.
If you have to drive, it was not a good day.
I usually
hurry up and wait.
Yeah, that just didn't work out the way I planned it. In any case, this is a show about, well, home theater, home entertainment, music, speakers, movies, streaming, occupying the brain. At Planet Wayne tweets, at Patrick Norton, so is 3D TV really dead now? Pound CES 2017. Hope not. Only just got a player. Pound. Too late to the game. Sad face. Wayne, I am glad you bought your 3D-capable Blu-ray player now, and if you have a 3D-capable TV, I suggest you treat it well. And don't tear it apart, because quite frankly, I don't think I heard a single peep about 3D, and I'm pretty sure Samsung's dropped 3D.
Everybody. I can't think of a single display manufacturer for televisions that's doing 3D anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't frankly care. I mean, I know a lot of people love it, but I've said this repeatedly, and I'll say it again, but if you really like 3D, pick yourself up an inexpensive projector. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a better experience all around in terms of field of view, adequate brightness out of these projection systems. If you're looking to do daytime 3D, that's a whole different argument. But there are plenty of capable, excellent 3D projectors for under $500, under $1,000, whatever your budget is.
At least this year.
Yeah.
We also had a question. We'll get to it later. But, somebody pointed out all they hear about is these giant TVs, and they're looking for something in the 37, 42, 50-inch range. They're out there. They just don't, spend the advertising dollars, for lack of a better phrase. It costs a ton of money to put something on the show floor. Hisense cares about that. TCL cares about that. And you might not realize it, but LG and Samsung do too.
There were no small screens to be shown at this show.
Yeah.
So this was all the more premium stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, they announced all those products, but, None of those were there to be had. When it comes to HDR and small screens, I think the closest you're going to be able to do this year would be maybe a high-end monitor. Mm-hmm. If you really want the quality, You're going to have to go with something like that. I'm not seeing any screens under like, say, 40-plus inches that are even approaching something I would call HDR light.
Which I think is probably reasonable.
And a lot of these TVs that are HDR compatible that can't deliver the brightness output are limiting your experience. So don't buy a cheap 4K HDR compatible TV and expect it to produce, you know, the light characteristics you're going to get out of one of these super premium sets that are rolling out right now. Or even an OLED. OLEDs are pushing, you know, 700 plus nits. And the reason for that being is that the further down this path I go in HDR, the more I realize is that that spec for light output is truly tied to the detail level of the video signal. It's different from how it used to be in the sense of I can reveal more detail in the picture without really considering the overall light output. With HDR content and HDR calibration and setup on these TVs, the two are so tied together. You have to have the light output in order to reveal the picture properly. And it's counterintuitive to me a little bit. I'm like, why can't I just turn contrast down and get more detail in the picture and that peak bright detail? And it's like, no, because then you'll be screwing with what they're doing at when it's all set to maximum and then optimizing the color.
Just gets crazier.
Small screens, HDR, that's going to be a struggle. Anything under 50 inches.
But small screens for 1080p, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. And you'll always have good options there. But if you're looking for that HDR experience with magnificent color and the brightness detail, that I'm just not seeing on small displays. Unless you're talking about some of those brand new HDR compatible monitors we saw at CES. And some of those look fantastic, I will say. I was looking at some sweet 4K high color gamut displays. The one that stuck out to me was a pro monitor LG had in their booth. And I want to say it was a 28-inch display, and it was doing I think it was doing 99% DCI, and it looked fantastic.
As an authoring monitor.
Yeah, to do some authoring work on that or something. But if you're looking for like game console setups and whatnot like that, that's tougher. Tougher on the small screens. Even with things like the PlayStation 4 Pro setup Sony had in their booth with to one of their new LCD panels displaying HDR. That was they were demoing it on a 65-inch screen. But, yeah, to do effective HDR, currently that's kind of limited to the larger sizes where things are already kind of a premium anyway. But, yeah. I'm sure that will change. It's just I don't see it for this year, at least. Small HDR is not really what they're focused on. As soon as that screen size gets under 40 inches, that's more into a value category where I think they're just looking to chop anything and everything.
Yeah.
It may be HDR compatible, but yeah. I'm looking at an HDR compatible TV right now, and it's there are differences, to say the least. And I got a stupid TV that's listening to my voice, apparently.
That would explain its strange behavior.
So strange.
At Evan Adams tweets, at Robert Heron, at AVXL, HDMI 2.1, good thing at Patrick Dorton hasn't run that new HDMI in his house yet. Well, you know, the nice thing is the things you need HDMI 2.1 for, which is essentially dynamic HDR, is not anything that's going to be affordable for me in my projector space anytime in the immediate future.
What, you're not running 8K 60?
Have you met me?
Not yet. You will
so,
be.
You know, don't get too worried about HDMI 2.1. It's great if you're buying like a television next year. Not that big a deal for anybody buying 4K right now.
One of the questions I had going into CES this year was, how the hell are all these TVs that are adding Dolby Atmos support doing anything other than just signal processing within the set itself? How are you going to get Dolby Atmos to return back to, say, that's being grabbed through maybe an app built into the TV, or the source is the TV for that audio? How are you going to get that back to the set? Currently,
magic.
All the current audio return channel specs don't enable any of those object-based audio formats to be brought back. And with 2.1, of course, there's a little paragraph here that says EARC now supports the most advanced audio formats, including the ones I just listed. So that's one of the cool things I like about the new 2.1 format, is that for high-end audio, for the ultimate audio quality, you can continue to use that ARC-enabled cable. They are saying in the fact, too, that it may require some new cables specifically for getting the max bandwidth. And that, to me, is an indication that the interconnects, the connectors for HDMI won't change. Most cables will be compatible with HDMI 2.1. It's just when you start approaching, if you need 48 gigabits of bandwidth for uncompressed HDMI 2.1, like AK video, that's where you'll probably need a specialized cable that is just certified to be able to make sure those that signaling is actually making it from point A to point B. Beyond that, well, the grand question will be, will any of the HDMI 2.0A devices or even 2.0B be upgradable? And the grand answer is, it depends. Depends basically on the capabilities of the chipset that were in the TV. There is a chance that you'll be able to apply a firmware update from your manufacturer and suddenly have it, you know, have all of these new features. I have a feeling they'll get dynamic HDR into just about any TV that currently supports HDR 10 and has HDMI 2.0A support. I don't think that's such a huge deal, but suddenly making a port do a full 48 gigs that you could somehow test and measure somehow. Not that you would even need that at the moment, but looking down the road.
Just in case.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who bought the latest TVs maybe last year are going to be okay. I think anything beyond that, not so much. Shouldn't be a whole big surprise, though, regarding that.
Probably the biggest announcement of the show, if you weren't a millennial being targeted by an automotive manufacturer, was LG and their W7 wallpaper design. Obviously, LG and Samsung battling it out, but you look at the LG, it's their, you know, they're sounding like a
signature OLED.
Yeah, like a graduate student thesis. You know, we've determined that 4 millimeters or less is the, you know, penultimate place to create this immersion and this wallpaper, this window, this you know, and fairy dust and mayhem and awesomeness, and you're just going to be drawn into the video experience. And what they didn't really talk about too much was the ribbon cable that runs from the 2.6 millimeter thick 82-inch flat panel that is full of magnets and mounts to basically a steel, what I assume is a steel sort of, you know, box rectangle shape you bolt to the wall first. That then runs down to a sound bar that was apparently designed by the same guy that did Kylo Ren's helmet, because there's this super minimalist, sophisticated, there's just nothing there. There's a screen. And then
that's it.
You know, if you worked really hard, you could kind of figure out, because they put these sort of, you know, gradients, these sort of, you know, vertical striping patterns in all of the glass panels. They had these flat panels mounted on to hide the ribbon cable that runs from the flat panel to the box.
They provide a subtle visual cue that there is something connecting.
Yeah.
There's some...
You say visual cue, I say attempt to hide it during photography or minimize its impact. But, you know, it's probably something you could, you know, you would bury behind something. But I always laugh because it's like, you know, the sophisticated elemental intrusion of light into the room with a minimal blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we got Kylo Ren's helmet designer dude to make the sound bar, because it's a big sound bar and it's got Atmos that pops up. And
if you're really, you can't deal with that sound bar. I did notice on LG Display's site for their signage webpage, they already have a version of that W style panel that you can use as digital signage that comes with a simple breakout box.
Oh, good.
However, that's commercial. You probably,
if you can find it,
probably don't want that in your house. And yeah, there's probably a significant VIG for that.
Well, the other thing is,
also, it's an 82-inch ribbon. I'll just mention real quick. It's a flat wide design, and it's not in wall rated. So, I think the 82-inch length is adequate for most folks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do plan to put that through a wall, you're either breaking the code or you've got to put a piece of not low voltage tubing or conduit. Somehow make that connection from the back of the TV or the bottom edge of the TV down to where the soundbar will rest. And there's really no other way for them to do that, because they're delivering video and power through that single cable.
Right.
That's how that TV is so thin. There's no inputs on this TV. It is literally a couple millimeters thick. Mm-hmm. It sits flush to the wall. It's gorgeous. Yeah. Slightly flexible display. You can actually pull up a corner, but it's not made to be installed in a curved installation or rolled up for that matter or anything like that. But
you're not going to want to put it on the walls of my 101-year-old house where it's not level plaster.
The nice thing is, for a lot of people, though,
you're going to be careful when you're doing it.
I would go so far as to say, for this type of mount, I want to say the 65-inch panel weighed less than 20 pounds, mm-hmm. and the 77-inch one weighs like 25, 26, 27 pounds. It's light enough to where you literally could hang that on drywall and not worry about it.
It's pretty cool.
I would still probably find a screw somewhere, but yeah, into, at least something into a stud. But
before we kind of continue with LG, something I should point out, because I know y'all are going to tweet and email askatavxl.com. There was pretty much, this was the year that nobody had a price and nobody had a ship date for so many products. Maybe more of the stuff I was running into,
Know,
on especially on the computer side of things. But there was a lot of later this year price TBA is a running theme, including last I checked for the 82-inch fantastic W7 wallpaper design.
Oh, no, that's just the ribbon length. But the
oh, yeah.
Those should be out in a couple months.
Okay.
Pretty soon, actually.
How much?
They're pretty good. I would say for the W7 wallpaper, the 77-inch one, mm-hmm. that's going to probably be 15 to 20,000. The 65-inch will probably be close to 10.
Was it 65, 77, and...
There's one other size in there, too.
Was it 100-inch?
No, they're not going any bigger than 77 this year. And I would love to see what the power consumption is on that large OLED, too.
It's pretty crazy, right? So brightness is up. DCI color coverage is up.
Yes.
The quantum dots in the W7 are emissive, which means the dots themselves make the light. The screen generates the light.
No quantum dots in OLED. At least not yet.
Yeah, sorry. I'm having a brain.
But you're right, though.
I'm a little obsessed with 82-inch ribbons instead of, you know,
it's an emissive display tech. Screens. And that's the beauty of it. It provides improved viewing angles because
there's no backlight.
Yeah, no backlight. So
the viewing angles are insane.
Viewing angles are quite good. And color performance is going to be excellent because of that super contrast. Mm-hmm. It is still, they're claiming in very small portions of the picture, they're up to 1,000 nits now, which is about a 25% improvement over last year. So this is not the standardized 10% window pattern that we're supposed to test HDR brightness with.
Right.
And they're not claiming that. They're claiming something like a 2 to 5% window can do it. Regardless, that just, they have improved light output on these OLEDs compared to last year. And yes, as you mentioned, the DCI color spec is right on that border of being a perfect 100%. It probably exceeds it a little bit. That seems to be, everyone seems comfortable doing good DCI color this year, hopefully with improved accuracy as well.
What was kind of crazy is you know, that left me sort of staring blankly in irritation and fear and loathing to get a, you know, at least one Hunter S. Thompson reference into this show, was the fact that they're doing Technicolor and HLG alongside Dolby Vision and HDR10. And Technicolor is essentially their thing with the nice people at Technicolor. And if you think you've heard that name, it's because you have, either at the beginning of an end or the end of just about every movie you've seen, or a staggering number of them. You know, and I was kind of like, HLG? Well, it, Doug, a.k.a. at Digital FX, gave us the heads up that HLG is co-developed by the BBC. It's being trialed by 4 satellite services in Europe, which probably gives it a leg up over Technicolor. Technicolor is kind of like, you know, a really cool thing to have on the box for LG.
It's an interesting partnership because, one, yes, it adds this fourth HDR standard now. So we have Dolby Vision, HDR10, Hybrid Log Gamma, and now HDR Technicolor, or whatever it's going to be. I'll be curious to see what content they're delivering in that format. The other cool thing I thought was that Technicolor is also adding a customized preset on this TV, mm-hmm. that's supposedly gone through by their color calibrators, and it's optimized. I'm hoping for more than just their own content, but I love to see anybody who's a master of color add their own preset that's well optimized. So maybe this is something along the lines of what a THX preset would be like on some TVs.
I mean, and Technicolor, like, you know, if Wizard of Oz, Technicolor.
Yep.
Most of the movies that are going to win at the Oscars, Technicolor. So they truly know what they're doing. You know, this is not as, you know, another tweet we had, Sheikh Bayunid, and I apologize if I have just butchered your last name. He says, is it really that significant or more like the encoder format wars like VC1 versus H.264? And I'd almost say it's less significant than that, or the encoder format wars.
Totally.
You know, it's just an irritation at this point.
It adds a little confusion to the process, but I think focusing on things like what it is within these formats that's important. It's the resolution, Yeah, mm-hmm. that's part of it. But it's really that, that expanded color palette, the ability to do the detail we want, and to be able to have that into something that, that, you know, I think it's showing capability in the sense that LG seems to be at, seems willing and able to add any format that comes along that they deem worthy, and their sets are ready to go for it. So yeah. if you're looking to author content in any of these formats, this is going to be a very capable display for you to use for looking at your work and things like that. And arguably the most compatible of the HDR TVs. But
that said, will there be any content in Technicolor? Who knows? Josh?
Something, but yeah. We haven't seen it yet.
As at Josh Willis, Willis tweeted, quote, good friend of mine in the industry says pretty much all studios are mastering Adobe Vision and it'll win out eventually. We'll see. Because right now you've got the fundamental issue is that Blu-ray, you know, was built around HDR10, and, you know, which technically it kind of came out of the research that created Dolby Vision.
Dolby is behind all of this.
I mean,
their tech went into the specs that made HDR10 and their own Dolby Vision standard.
I wonder if the Blu-ray consortium just refused to have Dolby Ultra HD Blu-ray
disc. Now there are at least four or five players coming out that not only support HDR10, but Dolby Vision as well on a disc format that we have yet to see anything encoded with either. When I work with colorists here in San Francisco who work on commercial projects, I see very few of them actually using encoding into Dolby Vision for the fact that there is a black box involved if you actually want to output that metadata to your project.
Mm-hmm.
And those black boxes are not easy to come by the last time I checked. So everyone would love to be able to support an open standard that I can just enable in software rather than require this specialized hardware box that might not be available to everyone. So yeah, I know the studios are hip to Dolby Vision, and people like Fox and Universal and those folks, they're going to get first crack at that kind of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
But for, you know, anybody less than that, not less than, but anyone without the pull of a studio or a budget of a
the
studio.
Budget of a studio.
Yeah.
The first of approximately 84 laser projectors we'll talk about. LG was displaying some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, just to finish up some LG coverage here. They had their ProBeam projector I mentioned a while back, their new portable. This is an update to the LED-powered one they had out. I think it was the PF1500 last year.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific single-chip DLP projector. The last one had RGB LED. This one is now solid-state laser going through, I'm assuming, a yellow phosphor color wheel to help it produce a nice 2000 nit light output at 1080p resolution. The big unknown I had was, were they going to continue to have that ATSC tuner built in? And I had a chance to look at one of these in action, and it had that RF jack, so I'm happy it has that ATSC tuner in it.
Nice.
No pricing or availability yet. I'm going to guess about $2,000 when it finally gets into street pricing, and that's going to be pretty good for a 1080p laser.
There you have it. Samsung.
Oh, my goodness.
QLED.
The Q.
And this is where my brain was frying, trying to put quantum dots, emissive quantum dots inside the LG W7.
Oh,
basically, new quantum dot technology being integrated into the Q9 / what we assume is also the Q8 and Q7. It was funny.
New metal core quantum dot.
Not emissive. There is still a backlight. It is edge lit.
For the Q9, Q8?
It is the best looking edge lit TV I've ever seen in my life. These, of course, were also the first three or four off the boat from Korea and had been lovingly prepared. Well, probably off the airplane, the custom chartered airplane from Korea.
I would guess
cases ever imagined for giant HDTVs. Much like, you know, considerably thicker, like, you know, closer to 2 inches thick.
The Q9
yeah.
was thick enough for me to initially guess that it had full array local dimming. And I was later encouraged to say that it didn't have that.
It don't.
And there are plenty of mysteries left to this particular display. The Q9 in particular, and I need to verify this in the Q8, but there was a new subpixel structure. Normally you have red, blue, and green subpixels that make up an individual pixel. And typically those are striped in a very even pattern. All the red subpixels line up, blue, green.
Mm-hmm.
Looking up close on the Q9, it clearly is not that way. They have staggered the layout in such a way for, I'm sure, some pretty unique reasons. I will say, just subjectively, the viewing angles have improved dramatically on these TVs.
Yeah.
It's still not perfect. It's still not exactly like an OLED, but it is, you have way less color distortion off axis. And that'll be important to a lot of people. The brightness, they're claiming for this year, Samsung's going to have on their Q789s will be in the 1500 to 2000 nit range. And I saw a hybrid log gamma demo running off of a direct TV satellite feed in the Samsung booth as well. So
part of the display that they did, these beautiful, one of the things that really caught my eye was this, you know, it was like a, you know, a stained glass window with light flowing through, showing these incredibly, you know, rich, delightful, saturated colors. One of the big things they were pushing is that it's the first time there's sort of a complete color volume or the largest color volume, which is a kind of a different way of thinking about it, because it's essentially a three-dimensional model, you know, from absolute white, which is one, and absolute black, which is zero. And traditionally in a television, as you jam things brighter and brighter, the colors become less saturated, more faded, more blown out. And they're basically claiming that pretty much up until everything goes white, much like being hit on the head with a baseball bat, everything's in full color and completely saturated.
Yeah.
So,
you know, again, that's probably a dig at what LG OLED does with that.
Oh, they were very much
RGBW, because, you know, all the OLEDs currently from any manufacturer who's using an LG panel, which we'll talk about in a second here, they're all using a panel that subpixel structure is red, blue, green, white, and then as the TV gets brighter and brighter, as it approaches peak white or peak brightness for a picture or a scene or whatever, in order for it to really dump light out, it's just simply dumping more white light, which desaturates things like color. And that's the argument Samsung was making. We can do high pure color rendering. That color volume, they actually, in a demo I was privy to, they showed off a 3D printed color volume of that TV.
It was pretty cool.
With the color volume printed out in a physical structure you could hold, so you could actually hold the color volumes in your hand. And
I wasn't brave enough to try to pick them up.
I wasn't at first either, but then they were tossing them around like beach balls later. And,
you know, what they're talking about in theory, though, is a 100% of the DCI P3 color volume space.
From black, and measuring the color space from either the lowest near black on up to peak brightness, it will give you that full DCI color coverage. So you should be able to render a something like a UHD Blu-ray movie in full color quality. You shouldn't be lacking
whatever
color
they saw. You should have like all of the color in all of the scenes,
And that 2000 nit brightness level for at least the Q9, I'm thinking the Q8 won't do it, but it'll still be plenty bright. That's really close then at 2000 nits in full DCI color. That's very close to what they're actually authoring these movies on. So I can't wait to go back and take a look at some content.
They're pretty crazy. You know, I should say
on something that comes as close as possible to what studios are actually using.
But they're talking about like the Q9 being like 1500 to 2000 nits, which is really, you know, if you have the classic corner glass apartment penthouse in Miami and you want to watch television with none of the shades pulled, this is the television you've been dreaming of for quite some time.
And as important to the brightness output is the ability to minimize reflections. And last year, and this tech's been around for a while, but something like a moth eyes technology where you have nanometer scale structures that have been either etched or built onto a layer on the surface of the TV. And it does a terrific job at minimizing a reflected light source, like a light above or below or something. And in the demos where I could get my head at an angle to really see the lights in the ceiling going off the screen, just subjectively, it was at least half of what it was last year in terms of reflected light. I was really impressed by that. Going back to LG real quick, they also have something similar for their nanotech on their panels as well, a small structure scale patterning that enables effectively better off-axis viewing by reducing reflections. That was a huge thing for all of the manufacturers this year, was to really, the stuff they kind of showed us last year, which was kind of impressive, sort of okay, it seems like they've really perfected that and stepped that up a level. So on all the premium TVs I saw, the ambient light reflection is a lot better, and I was super thankful for that. And let's see. Another cool thing. We were talking about the ribbon cable on the LG panels and just minimizing the link between your gear and that display itself. And Samsung had their own take on this. And one of my cohorts jokingly referred to it as a quantum fiber, since we were all talking about the quantum everything. But this is just to their One Connect box, they now use a piece of fiber optic, a transparent, clear-ish piece of filament. That I think they're shipping 5 meters in the box. You can get up to 11 meters custom if you need it. This will require, of course, power on both ends. You're just running right. light across this connection, unlike LG's ribbon cable. But this is literally like a piece of fishing line. And if you're comfortable taping that to the surface of your wall, this should have no issue running even in wall. It's light. I don't believe there are any codes related to running a fiber optic cable in a wall, but I could be wrong there. Don't quote me there. But having that fiber optic link to the One Connect box really, again, just cleans up your environment. Just makes it for a very clean look for the display itself. And that would literally leave you then on at least an LCD like that, just needing power behind the TV.
Right.
So you can drive it that way. That was fantastic. They also showed off some a neat wall mount setup, a custom wall mount they have for their QTVs. I don't know if it goes down to Q7 or not, but the Q8 and Q9 for sure. Basically, where you would attach the base stand on this TV can be taken off and replaced with a mount that places most of that hardware inside of the TV itself, so you can get a very tight mount to the wall surface itself, yet still have up to 10-degree angle if you need a little tilt to make it look just right. But these kind of, let's get the screen not only flat, but as close to the wall as possible. Oh, yeah. Probably the biggest news. Well, not the biggest news, but that Q9 TV is flat. And so far, Samsung has yet, I can't remember the last time Samsung introduced a flat flagship TV. Last year at this time,
they did have a curved flagship TV up there too, but the emphasis was really on the flats. Based on the number of flat screens hanging in the room where they did that presentation, they're real big on the flat screens.
All of LG's OLEDs are flat this year too. That's going to be a terrific. The thing I am most curious to see is if, one, you've got the mounting situations that are going to be great for a lot of people, being able to put these TVs wherever you want. The new connection styles to be able to minimize, just so it cleans up the look. And for that, the new Quantum Dot Tech, I think, it's increased the DCI color coverage. It's more efficient and brighter. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I have some other stuff, too, about what Nanosys, the company that Samsung purchased earlier this year, actually, is doing in their Quantum Dot demonstration at the show. I thought was particularly fascinating and probably will give you a clue as to what Samsung's going to do for the next 3 years. If you want, I'll just run down that real quick. It was actually kind of fascinating.
Do it.
One was effectively going over what's available now as far as how quantum dots are used in TVs. And as I madly scroll through my notes, currently we're using something called a photo-enhanced backlight. Mm-hmm. Or not a photo-enhanced backlight, but a photo-enhanced color filter. So effectively, a layer within the screen. Actually, it wouldn't even be the color filter. It'd be just an impregnated sheet behind the color filter as it currently is. And they call that effectively photo enhanced, where some of the blue light is converted into red and green. And then that creates a very robust white light that then gets pushed through the color filter. There is still a color filter there. And this is the same with OLED, too. OLED is a white material that has a red, blue, green color filter on the front. That's not ideal either. But the next gen will be something called photo-emissive. This will effectively replace the color filter. So where you'll still have red and green and blue subpixels, effectively that blue subpixel is going to be clear, allowing the blue light from the backlight system to come through, and the red and the green will be emissive rather than transmissive, although it would have to emit some light through it as well. The point being, it'll get rid of the need to have a separate color filter, and that will not only thin the display, but it also will go to improving off-axis viewing and other issues like that. And then the third one will be, say, about 3 years out, they're saying, electro-emissive. When I talked about this too, an electron-stimulated quantum material where you don't even need a light to charge it. You can stimulate quantum dot materials with, you know, photons, sure, or an electron. And that's really where they're heading toward eventually. And these new formulations for the metal core quantum dots are part of that. The big deal I also saw for this year was making their products air stable, in a sense, so they can be applied in a greater variety of high temperature manufacturing processes, either when they create LCDs or other panel techs. Sometimes if it's anywhere heat's involved, organic materials can break down rather quickly. So having something that's really inert and stable and good to go is really what they're pushing for, and to make it cheap too. So this year, the current tech, photo enhanced. Next year, we're going to get something that's photo. We're going to get rid of the color filter next year. I can't even begin to tell you what a big deal that is. That color filter has just been in the way of viewing angle performance for too long now in LCDs. And
just ruined everything.
3 years or less, we'll be seeing something even better with that emissive, direct emissive quantum dot. So it's still a little bit off. I'm not going to guarantee anything, but I keep hearing the rumors that, yeah, this next CES will actually have that second stage, the photo emissive quantum dot displays that replace the color filter. That's when you're going to see me doing a little happy dance.
So. Oh, my goodness. Hisense. It was funny. There's this kind of battle for third place between Hisense and TCL, where they're both very adamantly spending a lot of their time at their keynotes basically explaining why, you know, they were going to take over third place, either, you know, in the U.S. or nationally. It was a curious thing. I mean, TCL launched 25 televisions,
so
most of them Roku-enabled, from super inexpensive to their top-of-the-line flagship models. Hisense was showing off the H10D quantum dot, 1000 nit, FLAD 120 hertz panel. One of the things they did is they talked about how they think short throw laser projectors are the future. That's they basically own the 100-inch market in China.
Yep.
You know, they're looking to bring the cost down on that, bring it to the United States. The you know, $10,000 seems like the price on that in my head. It's an interesting, you know, it's basically a laser projector, short throw.
You are spot
on. You know, maybe
on.
10 inches from the wall.
Usually about 108-inch screen.
Give or take.
The screen tech's the big deal, though, too. And we saw a lot of these, but just to say that it uses a light-rejecting screen. So it's very good at dealing with light that's not being shined directly on the screen from the projector, and keeping that from interrupting and desaturating and your picture. And we saw lots of great demos of this, but that's one of the key things for these short throw projectors. They had that short throw projector on display right out in front as you were walking by their booth. If you were fortunate enough to walk around that, though, on the very other side of the wall was something I hadn't even seen yet from them. And it was an updated version of their LaserCast 4K projector using dual color lasers, specifically a red laser and a blue laser combined. And they were claiming that they're achieving greater than 95% BT2020. And folks, that's as high as it gets right now from I've seen from anyone, even commercial cinema. That's the level they were showing. As far as projectors you could see walking around the show floor, that was the best one I saw. It's a prototype. I'm sure we'll see more of it. I even offered to fly out to China and hammer it on that for them. Gladly. But that was such a pleasant surprise in their booth. Their H10 flagship looks great. They had, I want to say, their new H8 looked great, too. They're improving everything with quantum dot technology. I have their H10C in-house right now that we're comparing and testing, and that's, you know, for a good value. It's not bad, but what I was seeing on that show floor, just the enhanced color performance of some of Hisense designs, and that bloody dual-colored short-throw 4K prototype was just fantastic looking. And I tried to find some. Granted, it was all their, you know, demo material and crap, but just the setup of it and that the color truly caught my eye, and they were showing that off, and I can't wait to see that.
It's a difficult CES. The only thing worse than trying to figure out televisions at CES is usually trying to figure out audio at CES, because so many of the rooms are so loud and so bright, and I, you know, the content is so staged. It was funny, Anchor, the cable company, debuted a brand called Nebula, and their first big product is going to be a 1080p version of that laser display, the laser projector that's so popular in China. And you know, there in that case, it's basically a short throw projector that sits on a sort of a cabinet in front of the wall. And you know, it's one of those things where you know you're going to want to sort of double stick tape it to whatever cabinet you put it on, or you're going to spend a lot of time, you know, realigning it every time somebody sort of shoves it out of the way to sit on that cabinet or whatever irritating thing they do.
Just briefly, Sony showed off an update to their short throw 4K laser. That's about half the price. It was about $50,000 last year for the one they introduced. This one's about $25,000. Still pretty pricey, but Sony is pretty damn good about providing state-of-the-art tech like 4K HDR in projection systems at reasonable prices. I mean, it's still premium, but what they were showing too was it embedded in a piece of furniture that was less likely to move. But some of the aspects of what you can do with short throw, this effectively turned a blank wall. They had a really neat app built into the Sony demo where it was displaying, it almost looked like you had hung art up on the wall.
Yeah.
It was creating such a visual effect that I was like, you know what? That almost looks like a shadow from a window. There's a clock up here in the corner, and the way it sort of the graphics blended in with just a regular plain white wall, it was actually kind of a neat way just to have that projector running all the time and to create some, you know, either a background scene or some kind of art. And then they also showed it being tied into like your music discovery and content discovery as well. And the interface looked fantastic. And I really hope that's something they actually do build into their projectors, because once you have that big image, if there's a way to, you know, interact with your own content in a better way, I mean, that's the do it, but please.
In some ways, I think Sony may have kind of won the 4K television battle. The Bravia A1E OLED television, 77 inches max, fantastic looking screen. They're doing their own Extreme engine for the HDR. I want to say decoding, for lack of a better word.
Oh, yes. They have a brand new engine they were super proud of. I would say the coolest thing about their new OLED, which is, yet again, an LG panel. like I said, there are about six companies now doing OLEDs based on LG panels. And who's currently making the best LG OLED panel? I'd like to find out.
Who is LG selling the best OLED panels to? Might be a better way
are they keeping them for themselves? Anyway, yeah, all the standard sizes for the OLEDs up to 77 inches. I think the coolest thing on this TV, without a doubt, was its acoustics. The audio built into this TV is actually, they call it acoustic surface. And what it is the whole panel is a speaker. And they do this by placing four actuators, two pairs, on a bar that's on the back of the TV. It's maybe sticks up about a half an inch. It's not a very big bar, but underneath that bar, if you ever look at the back of the set, is where they incorporate these two, not transducers, but those actuators. And with the two pairs effectively acting as stereo speakers, the sound truly seems to come straight out of the screen. And to a very nice effect. If you're dealing with sound that's coming out the bottom edge of a TV, like on a lot of flat panels, having it shoot right out the middle is a neat effect, especially when you're up close to it and you can really tell where that sound's coming from. This TV, I will say right up front, design-wise, is a little odd in the sense that it's on an easel-like stand. And so it's not, yes, the panel itself is super thin. However, this stand also incorporates a subwoofer and all the inputs on it.
Yeah.
So even when it's folded flat, this thing is still going to be riding about 4 inches off the wall.
That didn't particularly bother me. They also, part of the reason maybe it didn't bother me
is
because
I wouldn't buy this TV to put on the wall necessarily.
You almost never saw it on the wall in the massive Sony booth. What you did see was it sitting in its easel mode,
gorgeous.
Which, you know, obviously I'm not going to keep a, you know, multi-$1,000, you know, 77-inch flat panel on the floor as long as the dog, the cats, and the children are in the house. But it really looked good. Like, you know, I mentally had my sort of, you know, my loft apartment in my alternate universe with the walls painted white and, you know, it was good. It was a really nice layout.
Oh, a quick props to that processing engine within their TV. And I'm sure other manufacturers are going to be doing this year as well, but all of the HDR, or at least that Sony Bravia could convert all video SDR or HDR, of course, into an HDR viewing experience that looked pretty damn good. So again, with all of these HDR TVs, you never see that peak brightness, even half of it, unless you're looking at HDR content. So as long as you can keep the color from getting crazy and you can scale the luminance and that color information appropriately, it's kind of nice that all of these HDR, premium HDR TVs now are allowing you to take all that content you have already, including regular TV shows and stuff, and just give it that punch that you might be expecting from a TV that's claiming, you know, 1,000 nits or whatever.
Right.
You're actually going to get that out of it with all content, not just HDR.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Oh, also, too, in the Sony booth, Sony showed off a commercial tiling system for creating super large displays, and I got to say, we'll get into that some other time, but it was seamless looking for the size it was. And
it was like looking at the size of a tractor trailer,
yes,
or a barn.
With very dense LED pixel structure. So it looked fantastic. If you need an 8K outdoor display, that might be the way to do it.
So, you know,
or your nightclub.
What did you consider the most accurate looking OLED on the floor?
Oh, just walk into Panasonic's booth and look at their OLED based on an LG panel. The EZ1000, man.
There's a theme here.
It really, just looking at that, you immediately knew somebody had fine-tuned that sucker to perfection. It looked fantastic. Digging into some of the details, they also have a new image processor they call HCX2, and they worked with a Hollywood colorist to fine-tune that sucker to make sure that their output on their version of LG's panel was fantastic looking, and it really was. And if you know or work with any colorists, they are the most color sensitive people I've ever met. Because you get a feel.
That's what they do.
You get a feel for it. As I turn to you for my headphone needs, I go to colorists if I'm really looking for, like, you know, which one looks perfect to you.
That's
anyway, that looked fantastic. Also, they have a, instead of your typical base designs for these super ultra-thin OLEDs, they went with integrating a stereo soundbar right into the base itself. So rather than having, like, you know, weird two-feet designs or some U-shaped hook, this just had, hey, why don't we just make that the soundbar and have it actually, you know, put reasonable-sized speakers in there blasting up a little bit and optimize that. And it really did a good job. There's nothing about that TV I can complain about, other than, will it be coming to the United States? I think it even has, oh, I got to confirm this, but I believe it even has a DisplayPort 1.4 on it, which already gives you HDMI 2.1 capabilities. Ah, anyway, that's another argument. One other sweet thing that I kind of stumbled across in the Panasonic booth was, and this is probably more on the commercial side of things, but they just had a transparent film that could be applied to any window for use with any projector to create an augmented reality style presentation. And the demo they had was like you were in, say, you're at a stadium watching a sporting event, and you're in your box, whatever the seat is, with a room where you have a glass to look out.
Right.
What if they covered that glass in this material, and then they could use a projector then to put up the score and stat information and other stuff dynamically on there as a display you can see through? As long as, and I can't imagine that material is all that expensive. This film. I assume not. Maybe it's something special, but I'm hoping this just becomes something kind of popular. I could see this being used for amazing signage and storefronts and things like that. At least after hours, you know, you're still dealing with light and other issues related to projection, but it was just something simple and effective. And I'm like, you know, if I had a spare 1080p projector and maybe it's Halloween or something, and I'm going to put some film on the big window out front and just freak everyone out, or I don't know. It was just cool, and I really did appreciate it.
There you have it.
All so much.
Projector of the show, if you have all the money, definitely JVC's new 4K HDR projector. We saw this somewhere deep in the bowels of the Venetian. Man, this must have been a 200-inch screen.
No, it wasn't that big. It was probably really? 110, 120 at
bigger
the tops.
Than that. Well, the DLA RS4500 does DCI color and beyond, a blue laser light engine, and a fixed phosphor design, six banks of eight diodes, $35,000.
It looked like it. I have not seen a home projector doing HDR, real HDR content, looking that good. the most eye-catching thing for JVC projectors is their ability to do inky dark black, mm-hmm. and this was fantastic looking. You combine that with solid DCI color representation, 100%, and beyond probably, and then that laser light engine, 20, 30,000 hours of output at, I want to say, 3,000 lumens, solid-state device like that.
It was pretty gorgeous.
My only complaints are is that when you do firmware and profile updates on their projectors, it's about as kludgy as it gets. You're using like a Ethernet cable here, a serial cable here, some old school DOS software. That's probably not DOS, probably like Windows 3.1. But anyway,
it has that feel.
I really want them to step that up. Oh, just a quick throwback though to Samsung. Actually, they're adding. One of the things that really pleased me on that Q9 TV, at least, I don't know if this is going to apply to the Q8 or anything else, but for calibration, mm-hmm. they're adding in an AutoCal function that will allow me to tie into my Calman software from Portrait Displays and actually run through the color volume and grayscale setup for HDR in a more automated fashion. This is something Panasonic's been doing for a long time, and I'm assuming their EZ1000 OLED does it, but seeing Samsung step up and say, hey, you know what? We know these TVs get fine-tuned. And if our flagship is going to be used in production environments, hey, how about we make it a little easier for these guys to dial that thing into perfection? So I was super thankful for that.
Man, we found EPV and Elite Screens running some demos of some new screen materials.
Oh, the light rejecting demos were really amazing. Impressive. Because here we are in these suites in the hotel room with not the best lighting setup. Sometimes, you know, they would turn all the lights out in the room to really let you take it all in. But for the rooms that weren't quite so dim, they were great opportunities to show off how light rejection can work for anyone in any setup. And the prices weren't outrageous. I mean, these are not cheap screens. These are definitely going to cost you probably four figures. Low.
Some of them were low, like in the $1,100 range. But
it's not going to be as cheap as a white tension screen or anything like that. But
boy, they looked good.
They did, and the comparisons even they would take a piece of standard gain screen material and just lay that on top of it, so you can just see how much more reflective it is for ambient light sources in the room. And these were some pretty strenuous tests they were doing in terms of, or at least demonstrations, like an obvious point light right above the screen, pointed at the screen, and it was doing a damn good job of maintaining.
Yeah, I admit, they've got the tension screens, they do a motorized tension screen, they do a manual tension screen with like a pull cord on it, which is a nice way to cut about a third of the price off of one of those. Not as much as I would have expected to remove all the motorizing or the motors and stuff, but really kind of compelling for, the next gen projection screen at the Norton household.
I keep thinking, too, if you're right on that border where you've got a room where you want to keep a projector in there, or you did it, and then maybe you're just having to black things out constantly to get it to be reasonable in terms of its picture performance. Consider these light rejection screens, because I'm becoming more and more impressed with what I'm seeing. If your projector needs a little oomph, this might be one way to do it. If you have a light controlled environment, this is probably not the screen material you need. You can save a lot of money, but just be aware that there are ways of dealing with rooms that might not be the best rooms for doing a projection setup in. And these screens are just impressive.
Man, one of the big deals on the audio side of things was the Hi-Res Audio press conference. And it's interesting because you had a really peculiar year this year, because vinyl albums outsold digital downloads for the first time.
As far as Hi-Res Audio downloads?
Well, not even about Hi-Res, just in terms of music. And this may be a UK number rather than a worldwide or a US number.
Is everyone just doing the all-you-can-eat packages? Is that like the...
Yeah, that, okay. Basically like...
No individual digital, track stuff.
Digital downloads are down. Streams are pretty much the big deal. And a few of the really big artists on streaming services are accounting for staggering percentages of the overall music listened to. I do not have the notes in front of me to talk about that, but I was laughing because I was looking earlier, and it's like there's the UK Telegraph, vinyl albums outsell digital downloads for the first time. I'm pretty sure that is a UK number, not a US or world number. But it was interesting to kind of look at in terms of how big streaming audio is now. And we've had options, right? We got, in terms of having a quality streaming experience. If you don't have it, I highly recommend spending the money to go to the premium, you know, the step up on Spotify, which is like a 300K stream. Tidal essentially streams FLAC, lossless audio files.
Nice.
But this is about, what I didn't expect this to be was to be so MQA oriented. Master Quality Authenticated, which we saw announced, Meridian Audio's encoding that was announced at CES in 2016. But so there was a high-res audio press conference held by the Digital Entertainment Group. They're announcing a Stream the Studio campaign. They want millennials to know that their music can sound better. You know, the Universal Music Group, Warner, and Atlantic were there, so big record companies. HD Tracks, the Chesky folks, or Mr. Chesky will be along with this movement, right? If you've been looking for high-res audio because you're curious, I don't know many people, if anybody, that I can A-B blind a high-res track and a lossless FLAC of the same song and have them pick it out. Maybe if you have the right kind of ears and the right kind of speakers, it's real thin. That said, my friend Jude from over at HeadFi says, look, I'll buy the high-res version, I'll buy the master quality audio version of a song simply because I want to know I have all of the music I can possibly have, even if I can't hear it, especially if it's one of my favorite albums. But
I'm nodding in agreement. I understand that thought.
You know, it's
as long as it's representative of how it was right there coming out of the mixing board or just the final product, if it's as close to that engineer's work,
that's the goal.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
You know, it's not something I'm not going out. I'm pretty particular. I own, probably 700 CDs because I want the original CD track, preferably from the one before, for example, Rage Against the Machine, before they can press the snot out of it for radio.
Well, it's like an 8K film scan. It's like I wouldn't mind access to all that data, but I don't mind the 2K Blu-ray. Yeah. It still looks awesome.
You got to have the right kind of eyes and the training to see the difference. So Tidal now has 200 albums in MQA. If you go to tidal.com/US/masters, Pandora and Rhapsody and Napster has said they're going to be doing high-res streamings. Tons of announcements were made around Master Quality Authenticated or MQA audio. Essentially, it's supposed to deliver high-resolution audio in less bandwidth than a CD. It's a lossy format. And basically, it fits inside of lossless containers like FLAC or Apple Lossless. MQA, a lot of very serious audiophile journalists were very big on MQA last year. These are also guys that probably can't take you seriously if you have less than $5,000 into a preamp. They have changed in the last decade, but, I would like to see some A-B tests. I would love to hear a difference and to be able to pick it, blind a few times in a row. Stereophile's got a really nice wrap-up of what's going on with that. Audarvana is doing stuff. Astell & Curran, Panasonic, Onkyo, MyTech, NAD, Blue Sound. AudioQuest is going to add it to their Red and Black Dragonflies. My understanding is there's about 15,000 albums in MQA right now, which is not a lot, but is certainly more than there used to be. We spent some time in the Emotiva booth. A lot of people don't know about Emotiva. They're starting to go back into dealer sales, which is why they were at CES, is my understanding. They've been for years direct sale. They're kind of an audio geek secret or a home theater geek secret.
Couldn't agree with that statement more. We ran into more people who would from other companies who own their gear as like, you want to get audiophile without breaking the bank? Just go buy their stuff.
Yeah, they do a really nice job.
Got my ears perked up, and I'm like, oh.
I think they had like 37 new products, and they have multiple lineups. They have like the Base X line is their entry level stuff. The X series is their top of the line stuff. And when you're talking about a world where people can tell you they're spending $5,000 on an amp. Without thinking that's even remotely unusual, to spend a few hundred dollars, $300-$400, $700 on an amp and get a pretty badass experience, i.e. flawless performance and some good longevity, is a big deal. So they had like five Basex speakers, the LCR, which is $149 each. They had satellite speakers to go with that for surround sound. Those are like two-way speakers, the one in silk dome tweeter and a long throw 4-inch mid-bass driver. Five Airmotiv speakers, which is their top of the line speaker lineup, the new RMC-1 processor, which is pretty interesting. Not to, as interesting to me as the Basics MC700, which is a 7.1 4K HDR home theater processor for $600. That just went on sale, and they've sold out. And they're going to do another run of those. You know, they're not doing Atmos with that. But then again, most people don't have Atmos titles to work with. They've started selling subwoofers again, both in the Airmotive and Basics lines. You know, an 8-inch, a 10-inch, 12-inch. You know, starting at like $199, $299, and $399. And then the whole new line of products called the Immersa series, or the kind of a lifestyle slim design OLED displays, which I'm guessing are going to fall in price between the Basics and the X series in price. That's my guess, not something I can guarantee. But you know, I like the company. I've got one of their, you know, I've got one of their Little Ego, which is actually you know, on they're selling those out for like $99 right now. It's a pretty burly little piece of hardware, but yeah, I finally got to hear the Airmotive T1 floor standards. Those sell for $700 a pair. There's like a folded ribbon tweeter, a 5.25-inch mid-range driver, 2 6-inch drivers, really nice home theater speaker. Got to listen to a little bit of music on them, too. I'd be really curious to get a chance to listen to those more extensively. But they added a new T2 speaker and the associated surround sound speakers to go with that center channel and surrounds. The T2s are selling for $499 each. It goes up to a dual 8-inch woofers. It was funny watching you process the folded ribbon tweeters, the air motion transformers.
I'm like, what the hell is that? What is that little thing right there?
Yeah, the patents on that ran out a few years ago.
And I saw these on several manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And at first I noticed it on the Emotiva stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why? What the hell is it and why?
Basically, it's
It's not that typical like dome style or right. Silk dome tweeters.
So a traditional
like
tweeter, whether it's a silk dome or titanium or unobtainium or whatever it's made out of,
does the not idea look with like that.
Yeah. So these are usually sort of rectangular, vertical, and they have what looks like fabric in sort of a folded fabric, like, you know, like the side of an accordion.
Almost looks like
inside of it.
If you didn't know any better, you almost picture it's like a folded piece of paper in there or something, or cardboard or corrugated.
It literally
something.
Is. Yeah. So what that does. Instead of a speaker, instead of like a tweeter that sort of a motor pushes the speaker, you know, to and from away from you. In this case, it looks a little bit more like, again, like pumping an accordion. And, you know, it's what it has is it moves really fast because it basically there's no mass. It weighs nothing. It travels a really, really small distance. Compared to a traditional dynamic driver. And so it's very, very similar to an electrostatic in performance. It's the idea that you get this super, super detailed, super, super well-resolved music. You know, not as much vertical dispersion, ton of side dispersion.
That was the key that I noticed, because even on some of the highest-end speakers, man, depending on the tweeter design, especially if it's a single tweeter, it's very point-like. And man, I mean, you can literally lean your head left and right and get a totally different sound out of a damn speaker. Mm-hmm. This was definitely wider.
Yeah.
I didn't move up and down to check that, but I know that was the first thing I noticed is that the tweeter sweet spot really widened out with that air motion transformer. Mm-hmm. And there's a good Wikipedia page on that too. And it goes over Dr. Oscar Heil, who invented it. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s. And apparently, I guess the patent is up now, so I'm seeing a lot of manufacturers adopting.
Yeah, there's like a $75 pair of speakers you can pick up from Parts Express that's using these. It's a pretty interesting idea. I mean, you know, Golden Ear, Dayton Audio, Emotiva, Martin Logan, ELAC, you know, a whole bunch of companies you're even less familiar with. You know, they use these air motion transformers now. They're pretty interesting. They're worth getting a chance to listen to. We're going to try to get in. We talked to the folks there. We're going to try to get in their $400 TA-100 from their Basic series, which is a stereo preamp. It's a DAC. It's a tuner. It's got an integrated amplifier.
Nice.
Sells for $400. It's on sale for $340 right now. The only thing it doesn't have that I wish it has is a subwoofer output. Because I'm seeing a lot more subwoofers that don't have the pass-throughs from the speakers to draw the subwoofer audio off of them. Fantastic build quality for the money. That's really what Emotiva is known for. Is basically, they're spending their money on quality parts, single-layer PCBs, putting a bunch of copper in there where it needs to be, and just generally trying to build the snot out of
it. Was that the room we had the, not too long of a discussion, but we were with the one gentleman who was really going over how any particular part screw up and or design, if it isn't all, if you don't have the flow through it correctly, there are so many steps that can just ruin audio quality. And I mean, granted, that applies to probably a lot of different.
I believe that would be the nice man who runs the company.
He was, I got to say, he was such a personable guy to hang out with and just seemed like a total no BS. I just love an audio man. And there's something different about that part of the show compared to like the chaos of the show floor.
Yeah,
compared to where I normally spend most of my time. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the Dan Laufman. Because he was talking to me about the how they build their stuff, and I showed him that I had a picture of the inside of that TA-100 on my phone, and he basically is, you know, scrolling my phone back and forth and, you know, discussing like all the different build elements. It was a good conversation. It was a good stop by there to see what they're doing. Certainly worth putting on your short list if you're looking for serious audio and don't want to spend
serious
a ton of money.
Or even if you're interested in creating some of these products, I couldn't imagine a better place to be in terms of things like interconnects and amplifiers and parts and designs and technique and...
You pick up a lot.
That was a wonderland for audio, man.
Yeah, and well, that's one of the nice things about all those. You know, they're not as crowded as the main show floor and the suites up there. They get pretty busy.
At least
busy.
The day we hit it.
Yeah, people, you know, most of the people relaxed. In that industry love music and they love talking about it. Kef debuted. They came out earlier this year, but I finally got to hear the powered version of the LS50, what they call their wireless speakers.
Nice.
They're $2,200, which sounds expensive, but you're talking about, essentially a speaker, a really fantastic speaker that now has, 192 kilohertz, 24-bit high resolution, a total digital signal path, dedicated DAC per channel, essentially functions as a preamplifier, a pair of 230-watt amplifiers, basically set up in a biamp dual mono configuration.
230 watts into that speaker?
Yeah, and that little
into
tiny...
one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be... Who needs this? Yeah, powered away.
Yeah, you might still want a subwoofer for the super low-end stuff, especially if you're watching movies. But it'll do like analog input, optical input, USB from a PC. It supports 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz dual-band Wi-Fi, Bluetooth 4.0 with the aptX codec. It's got... You know, they can connect
that's everything
to,
I need.
You know, like you can basically have like 8 different Bluetooth devices and then another 4 inputs for like 12 inputs in total. There's a subwoofer out on that should you want to have, the stuff below 50 or 70 hertz. One of the nice things, they do EQ presets on that, on the back of that speaker with its little big, and it's got a big giant heatsink on the back, which I love. But you can hit a button if it's, whether it's on a desk or a stand, or if it's up against a wall or out in free space. There's an Ethernet jack to connect it to your home network. And then there's another Ethernet jack that runs to the left speaker. So that was pretty cool. I had worn Robert out before I could get him into the ELAC booth because I was just on a tear on Friday. Saturday I was on a tear.
Yeah, my eyes were fried. I'd seen too many pixels.
So ELAC, right? Andrew Jones left Pioneer, goes to ELAC, does the B6 debut, which sells for $270 a pair. At CES last year, the Unify UB5 would sell for $500 a pair. I bought a pair of those, and they're in my living room right now. This year, he brought a new sealed speaker, the Adante. Now, it's $2,500 a pair.
Sub-design?
Speaker.
Loudspeaker,
like
okay.
They're going to do, like the others, they're going to do a bookshelf. And a stand-mounted and a floor-mounted speaker. Really interesting design. It's sealed, and I'm going to wait until I can, write down it. But it basically involves having the woofer inside a box inside the speaker that's essentially wrapped by the speaker. And if I'm not mistaken, a passive radiator coming out the front. I don't know if I have that right or if the passive radiator is somewhere in there, but it's a
fascinated now.
Yeah. I couldn't write fast enough to get all the ideas down.
I'd also like to take a look if there's any software packages out there that go into speaker design.
Oh, there are. And from the words of one of our acquaintances, you can, with some very inexpensive or free speaker design software, you can design yourself a pretty good speaker. You can't do that with headphones yet.
No, with a speaker,
you can do that. But
even some of the demos we saw in the Venetian were done, oh, this happens to be my speakers that I built and brought with me. And I was like, every now and then somebody would pull that line out. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
This sounds awesome.
We should build, well, we should go, Mattisound or Parts Express all sell speaker kits, including there's ones you can buy. There's ones you can buy what they call like knockdowns, which is essentially the box is in the box, so you don't have to do a lot of woodworking.
Oh, forgive me, but I forget it wasn't Parts Express, but Dayton Audio.
Yeah.
They had the gentleman from Dayton Audio, or at least he was working on a project for them, and he had those that kit for $900 unassembled. I think it was said 12 to 1500 assembled per pair for these array speakers that had a beautiful curve to them. They stood about 5 feet tall at least.
Yeah.
And they weren't tiny by any means, but
they look like the stem of a flower bending in the wind.
Yeah.
Right?
So with, I want to say, like 2.5-inch drivers, probably a couple dozen of them on each one.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably not that many, but like 20 on each one. And these provided a very wide sound field in terms of you could really be seated just about anywhere in the room and get a good stereo presentation.
That's kind of those are line arrays. I'm not sure if those are the audio artistry. We'll try to do some more.
And
on
at that price point, I'd get the $900 kit just to put that together.
Well, I think it's $900 each.
Oh, well. No, I'll save up.
Well, you know, yeah, but you know what? You can pick
up budgets.
Well, what was really cool was hearing they had the Dayton Audio Parts Express sells a Dayton Audio 18-inch subwoofer with a amplifier, a plate amplifier, and a cabinet for like $900. And it was cool to finally hear those 18-inch woofers. Those are subwoofers. Those are pretty badass. What we could do is the Overnight Sensations. You know, those sell for like $118 for a pair of near field or like desktop monitor speakers. You know,
I think that's what I'm going to do. Get myself some T-Class amps. Have a little fun.
Yeah, T-Class amp with a better power supply is pretty amazing. But yeah, or the other one that a lot of people really like is the Tri-Trix MTM TL speaker. And those, again, it's a cabinet and the components. It's like $280 for two floor standing speakers. There's a lot of good options. We can build some speakers. That would be fun.
That just encouraged.
But yeah, Parts Express is a fun website because they also have been doing a bunch of Bluetooth integrated amplifiers that I really want to build like a next generation boombox.
Okay, there's one significant difference between the TV side of things I deal with and the audio side of things is that it seems a lot easier to find and meet and talk to the engineers on the audio side. The TV guys, they hide those people on purpose. They're guarded.
Yeah. Well, then, it's also your time, but very, very different economies of scale for most of these companies. At Bro Paul tweeted, at Patrick Nord, at Robert Heron, any chance for a review on the new ELAC speakers anytime soon? My understanding is Mr. Jones is finishing his tweaking, then they'll go into production. He had literally, like, this is another case where he got to hear them, I think, at CES or right before CES. I will happily review them if they're willing to send me a pair of $2,500 speakers.
I think they will.
Probably more likely to take a look at the Element Series, their integrated amplifier. Sells for about $700, 80 watts per channel into 4 ohms. It's a Class D amplifier, switched amplifier. But what it does that's really fascinating to me is what they call ABC or Auto Blend and Calibrate, where it will run a series of test tones through your subwoofer and match the subwoofer output to the speaker output.
Awesome. Anything like that.
The Audiophiliac thinks it sets the subwoofer level too low, but I think it'd be interesting to experiment with it just because the idea that it will actually do a lot of the pain in the ass matching of the crossover point to make it work for your subwoofer with your speakers in your room.
I know some people aren't into the automated anything. They'd rather just fine-tune it all themselves. But for a lot of people, most folks just literally take stuff out of the box and just turn it on. And if there's any way to just to help improve that experience without a lot of pain and suffering or none, any kind of auto update or calibrate, especially in sound or listening, if it works, I'm down with that.
You know, to do a sort of a high-low combination, I think we both were completely blown away. Revel speakers had their Salon 2s, which is their top-of-the-line speaker system, on display. And I don't know if these speakers are actually that good or they just happen to be the perfect speaker for the suites that were being – all the audio equipment was being displayed in the Venetian. But they sounded – extraordinary, like to the point where I don't think I've ever seen Robert crawl across a room to take pictures of a speaker through a crowd of people.
I'm now scrolling through my photos like a madman here. I know that was like one of the very first things I took a picture of. I think it was a different model, but it was a freaking work of art.
Yeah,
is really what it came down to.
And they sounded amazing. Oh,
I'm close.
Yeah, there's like 3 8-inch woofers.
$50,000 tube amp. Oh, here we go. Oh, no, I'm thinking of the Karma. Those Karma speakers we saw in that one room.
Those were crazy. Those were like 9 feet tall.
Yeah. I was like, how did you get these in this room?
Very carefully.
I don't even want to transport speakers like that.
Well, I mean, I've seen, you know, actually, 17th century cabinetry that wasn't put together as well as those Karma speakers. But the ones I thought sounded the best were those Revel Salon 2s. That's a $20,000 a pair set of speakers if I got the pricing right.
There were a couple rooms I walked into where normally I'm like, wow, there's a lot of gear sitting over there. But man, when it came to life, I was like, holy crap. That really is just delicious ear candy. I don't
know. Somebody really cares
about
this.
Take my money.
You know, the flip side also, it was great. We got to talk to one of the engineers from Texas Instruments. And
that was such a fascinating conversation.
It was a great conversation.
The guy who brings his own speakers. Oh, I built these speakers. They sound great. And he was using those, tweeter technology, the air motion transformer. I was like, wait a second. Didn't these just come off patent? It's like, yeah.
A while
you can
ago.
Buy them now.
A few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they were of course, showing off, like, they were talking about their TPA 32 series, which is something you probably have heard a lot in your life, just never knew it because it was inside somebody else's product. But that was a fun. That was a fun conversation because he was basically very blunt. Like, you know, you can get some pretty good sound out of, like, you know, $5 worth of parts.
A chip or two. And literally this demonstration was bare boards laying out wired together to his own handmade speakers. And it was fantastic sounding, man. The only thing I didn't get out of that was, hey, can I get a reference board that'll do a HDMI input? And can I effectively buy reference boards that I could just put into my own box and just build it out?
So that's why you need the inexpensive. You need that inexpensive Emotiva. You know.
Oh yes, that's it. I'm just
to do the HDMI switching, the HDCP. The problem is the expensive HDMI and HDCP 2.2. I think is going to prevent them from doing a lot of dev boards on that. But yeah, there it is. The card for the TI Audio card for get 50% off a TPA 32. 44, 45, 50, 51, or 55 evaluation modules. So.
I mean, if you have any electrical sense whatsoever, if you've ever built a circuit board, and you have any interest in audio, I would honestly try to create something because it was like the reference designs are there. If you keep it simple, you can do some quality output and amplification and whatever many channels you need and what sort of power envelope you're looking for and. You can literally build it yourself. And granted, they were giving us prices for buying 1,000 parts at a time, so I'm not sure what the if there's something like Adafruit or wherever I can get, like, you know, a chip, somebody's buying them in bulk and selling them.
I can help you with that.
Maybe somebody's grabbing some of those TI reference boards. And anyway, they were just showing, within simple board designs with good chip technology and their latest generation of parts seem to be pushing things like the noise floor lower, pushing clipping past 100,000 hertz. So yeah, this is strictly an HD audio, not a demo, but just if you are working in HD audio with frequencies up to X, Y, and Z, here are parts that will actually support all of that without just totally ruining your sound and things like that. So
here we go.
I was
the high fidelity 175-watt Class D audio amplifier reference design. TI.com/tool/TIDA-00874.
I just suddenly want a bunch of boards. Do it myself.
Here we go.
Thanks again to just TI for that demo. A great room. Mm-hmm. Having a super knowledgeable person there who was clearly and so comfortable about it all too.
Yeah.
It's like, here's what it is. Oh, you want to do that? $10 in parts. Blah, 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 blah. Just get it right. Don't screw it up. Live long and prosper.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, here's a 60-watt stereo, 110-watt peak PurePath Ultra HD analog in-audio Class D pad-down module. We have a lot of learning to do. But then again, we always have a lot of learning to do. But, yeah, that was cool. 50% discount on that eval board. Man, Dolby Cinema finally arrives in San Francisco. I was with child and rainstorm, so I did not brave the trip into the AMC Metreon. 58-foot wide curved screen.
Yeah. It was beautiful. Yeah, believe it or not, Dolby's home city of San Francisco didn't have a public Dolby Cinema theater within the city limits until a couple nights ago. So yeah, the AMC Metreon here in San Francisco has a official Dolby Cinema screen. It is using a Dolby enhanced Christie Digital 6P laser projector, which is, I gotta say, one of the finest display devices I have seen in a commercial venue anywhere. Impressive all around. If you've ever been in any of the Dolby Cinema AMC theaters, the Prime, I don't know if they call them Prime theaters or not, but there's a certain motif. The speaker cones you'll see throughout the cinema will be backlit red. Very similar design I saw to the AMC Empire in New York for their Dolby Cinema theater as well. One sweet thing that was different about this particular theater, maybe this is a common theme with their Dolby Cinema installations, but right as you walk toward the theater itself within the commercial complex, that particular theater will have a special facade to it that highlights it as a Dolby Cinema theater. But as soon as you step beyond that portal, their whole goal was to like immediately start to take you out of, or to bring you into the entertainment environment, let you forget the outside world. They had a series of short throw projectors, though, as you walk through the corridor to get into where you can finally climb up and find your seat. But in this corridor, it was short throw projectors just illuminating the wall with specialized content related to the movie, mm-hmm. like a scene from that movie or something that was being looped in a way to kind of like bring you into it. And that was actually just kind of a nice intro. And you could see how that could totally be dynamically changed for whatever content, maybe the either the movie studio or maybe even a clip from the movie or something that could just be applied to this wall in kind of a very, very creative way. Performance-wise, we went through a series of demonstrations just kind of showing off how Dolby is using the system and this Christie Digital 6P projector. Unbelievable contrast performance. They do a demonstration, and this might be common in certain Dolby Cinema theaters, but they'll put up a white spot on a black background. Maybe this is like a 3 foot wide, 3 foot diameter circle. It looks impressive. And they're simulating what regular theaters do. And if you look at that, if you let your eyes adjust a little bit, you'll notice that, yeah, that black background is glowing a little bit, but it still looks really good. And then they go, okay, we've measured regular theaters, even our own. And this is the difference of having a laser projector in a setup like this. And then they go, boom, flip the switch. That white dot becomes about 3 or 4 times brighter. That back background went from a pretty dark black to I can't perceive the damn light. If there is light being shined off that part of the screen, I can't see it. It's just inky, inky dark. And because of that level of contrast, they're claiming 1,000,000 to 1. That's probably an accurate assessment given the light output and the black level they were achieving in a projection setup. They ended up highlighting the performance of this particular projector with a Disney Pixar demo that they had it re-rendered. They had the artist go back and do one short clip from this movie in a way that took full advantage of the projector's capabilities. And this went beyond P3 color. Uh-huh. The P3 color space is what they use in Hollywood for your commercial cinema. Mm-hmm. That's what gets transferred over to the UHD Blu-rays. That's what we see in most theaters. They just said, okay, we know what the capabilities of this projector are. It's like, I want to say 95% Rec 2020. Probably not that high, but pretty close. Definitely exceeding P3. They were able to define that color space, have the artist go back and re-render the scene to that color space. And holy cow, man, I am still like in awe of some of the shades of red I was seeing. Just so dark, deep and saturated to beyond any other display system I've seen to date. And I was tweeting out like a madman to the Christie Digital folks, and it turns out I have a contact over there I didn't even know of. So I'll be, I want to get into how they do their calibration setup and content management on their back end a little bit, especially on the projector side. I'm really curious to see, how do you fine tune a display system that big, and what kind of equipment are you using? Is it similar to the gear I use, or what? So I'll be digging into that more so in the coming weeks, but if you're not a home theater fan, or you know, you're just looking for a good commercial experience, do keep an eye out for these Dolby Cinema theaters. They are truly different in terms of the audio and visual presentation. I ended up staying while the credits were rolling, just to listen to the sound and the music and from the soundtrack of the movie. They always play extra sound or extra music at the end of a flick. It's just fantastic. Hats off to Dolby. Hats off to the AMC folks. They were talking about their initial plan for rolling out these Dolby Cinema theaters to AMC commercial theaters throughout the country. And they had a plan, a time frame of like 2024 to get like 150 screens deployed. They're already at like 170, and it's not even, they're like 7 years ahead. It's like, as soon as they got a look of how good it could be, they're like, okay, we just got to start replicating this out. And so throughout the United States, there's at least 150 of these screens, I think, in existence now, several in Europe as well. So just keep an eye out for those 4K laser projectors, especially when they're fine-tuned by the good folks at Dolby and Christie Digital. It's just fantastic. And I'll dig into that and get more detail about exactly what's going on there in terms of how those projectors are different from like a laser projector in the home and other aspects of it. What makes it so damn cool, besides being probably a $500,000 projector. And of course, they have two of them just in case they ever want to do 3D. But right. Anyway.
And then we get really complicated. Oh my goodness. We had a lot to cover, so we've talked about a lot. So we're going to jam through some viewer questions.
Yeah. We're 90 minutes in.
Oh my goodness. Sorry about that.
No.
At Kiddo1986 tweets, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, at AVXL. Did you see smaller HDR TVs during CES? All the news was about big. I want 32 to 37 inch for my PC PS4P/X1S. I think the closest you're going to get is some of the...
We covered this question.
I forgot is Dell is doing HDR capable monitors
that's
now.
That's right. And didn't they also show off an 8K others. Display as well?
Yeah. Well, let's not get into the 8K display.
No, but that's the only thing. For small screens, I'm only seeing the PC folks doing anything right now.
In terms of HDR, but yeah, I was going to say there's just several HDR computer monitors showing up at CES.
And serendipity, I talked, I think, a week or two ago about that new graphics card I picked up, the new 10 series cards from NVIDIA. Those actually happen to support HDR for the first time. And boy, I'm glad I bought that video card. Glad I waited a little longer so I can actually drive some of these monitors. I'm looking forward to that.
But yeah, LG has a 32-inch 4K 32U D99. Asus,
you're going to be paying more for these though than any TV.
No, because like the Dells, let me see if I can get the price. You know, just last week I still knew the price of this Dell monitor. Dell's got a 2718D, which is costing $700. So you are going to spend more than you're going to spend for a, you know, mediocre. To decent
4K TV.
4K, 50-inch 4K TV.
I want to say it was LG that had one of their new HDR PC monitors right next to one of their OLEDs just to show off, we're doing HDR on this. And it, you know what? It's an unfair comparison showing LCD and OLED, but side by side, really. But it still looked pretty good. It's definitely a step up in terms of color and brightness that I've seen out of PC monitors today, anyway.
Getting there. There are some questions about whether or not it's using the same HDR as televisions, but that's a whole nother line of conversation. And we should see more HDR computer monitors showing up through the course of this year because, you know, Netflix. Justin Ellingwood, aka at Jellingwood, tweets, Bose SoundTouch 300 or Onkyo's new SBT-A500? First thing I want to say is, look, both Robert and I prefer separate speakers and AVRs. When we can manage it, right? There are a billion reasons to use a sound bar. It's cheaper, it's faster, it's easier. It doesn't confuse the person you're setting it up for. It doesn't take up much space. You don't have to run cables to the back of the room. You don't have to hide an AVR.
And really an easy upgrade.
Yeah, and cheap sound bars can sound really good, irritatingly good.
If you have, especially for hearing impaired people, and if you just need a little something to make it easier to hear the damn TV, just throw a sound bar on there.
Yeah, I mean, from those two, the SoundTouch 300 Onkyo's SBT A500, I'm going to lean on the Onkyo's SBT A500, which is more expensive, but they've got Dolby Atmos speakers built into the soundbar. They've got a separate dedicated receiver with multiple HDMI inputs. It'll do Chromecast. Hopefully it's going to street for less than its $999 MSRP. I am told that the Pioneer Elite FS EB70 is essentially the same soundbar. And one of the things I've found out is Onkyo and Pioneer Home Electronics are basically one company, or as one of the reps referred to it, Punkyo, or Ponkyo. They're also doing headphones and some really, really nice FLAC players under the Onkyo brand, and one which could actually potentially become, you know, basically evolve from an Android-based high-resolution audio player with a lovely volume knob and play, pause, skip buttons on the side into an Android phone. And if that happens, I'm selling the cats, much to the shock and horror of my children. And
goodbye, pets.
I'm getting rid of the pets, and I'm buying me that phone.
You're free.
Oh, man. Nicholas Smith tweets, at Patrick Norton, I was wondering who makes the best portable FLAC player for around $300, give or take. Thanks. Mm. So for $300, Fio comes to mind, or Fio. You can find them on Amazon.com. Their X1 player costs about $80. The prices go up from there, the X1, X3, X5.
Something that has like an integrated amp in it as well?
It's essentially...
A headphone amp?
It's a screen,
a
twirly knob.
Gotcha.
Media player. The ability to play back lossless audio files, FLAC files, high-resolution audio files, a headphone jack. It's got a DAC and an amp. Yeah, actually, I was amazed because I bought one of the X1s because somebody.
Like I'm shrugging, going, my phone plays FLAC. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. That's a whole nother.
Shoot me down.
I'm not going to shoot you down.
No,
just saying, you can get your phone to play FLAC. You can get your phone to play FLAC. You know, throw one of the AudioQuest Dragonfly Blacks onto an adapter on your phone, and if everything's behaving correctly, then you'll get some pretty fantastic audio output. And I got to say, the output from an iPhone from the headphone jack is fantastic, but getting FLAC to play through it is irritating. Cue emails, ask at avxl.com, and we'll get into that another time. But that Fio player for $80 sounds fantastic. And you can put the current version, I believe, I want to say supports two, I should double check that, micro SD cards, but you can stuff a whole lot of,
I love micro SD cards.
Yeah, man.
Load them up
cheaper. So you can get like a 128 gigabyte micro SD card in that. There's just not a lot, and there's a whole bunch of high end stuff. Astell and Kern pretty much invented the portable FLAC player, i.e. the sort of, serious audiophile grade portable audio player.
That solid copper thing.
I wanted you to hold
hand.
That. I wanted you to hold that.
That was so ridiculous. That was a weapon.
Yes, that is.
That was okay. That was topped only by that whatever product, high end product we were looking at, where they took the cheapest plastic remote and put it in this beautifully extruded aluminum like chassis around it. And to make it weigh like 5 pounds or something.
Yeah.
I was like, wait a minute. This is just a cheap-ass plastic remote inside
with
a
beautiful piece of machined aluminum wrapped around it.
I'm not saying that was what this slab of copper was from Astell and Curve, but holy.
No. The slab of copper from Astell and Curve is copper.
That was just like...
But that's also like, like a $3,000 audio player. That said, Astell and Curve...
One of the specific designs of that series. Yeah. They had a version that's like, oh, you want it in solid copper? Here.
But yeah, I mean, Fio's normally in that range, and it turns out Astell and Kern has a sale on their AK Junior, which is their entry level audio player. It normally sells for $499; it's selling for $299. They make really nice products. They're really, really clean. They do firmware updates. My AK100, which is the first product Astell and Kern debuted, I want to say it's closing in on 5 years old. It's in really good, you know, it's as long as I don't drop it down a flight of stairs, yeah. it could, you know, it could should continue to run indefinitely. The higher end FLAC players from you'll find running Android and can stream Tidal, which is pretty cool if you are have discovered the Tidal music experience.
Too, since you mentioned the LG V20 or VT mm-hmm. or V20, I think it is, their new phone with the decent audio in it.
Yeah.
That's something I'm going to be paying more attention to going forward. Cause if I'm dropping a few $100 on a new product for just audio, man, if I can have a better phone instead, granted, having a separate device that you become intimately familiar with that you can just bring it from mobile to mobile device or whatever.
I think that's
a little more consistent and probably audiophile, but
this is one of those areas where the more you spend, the better the interface gets in no uncertain terms. You know, the entry level ones are they're a little clunky, you know,
gotcha.
But they're also under $100 and all the money has basically been spent on the DAC, the headphone amp, you know, and getting the interface to work and play stuff. But yeah, that's a really good deal on that. Astell and Curran AK Jr. for $299 is really, really good. And the FiO stuff, you know, they just debuted a next generation one. And that is the older generation one is selling for $79.99, and the next generation one is selling for $100 on Amazon. Any of those three, Nicholas, should delight you. The only place the less expensive FiO ones suffer is if you're trying to drive planar magnetic headphones off of them.
Gotcha. Or you just need more current.
You just need
more juice.
More juice.
More magical pixies?
More voltage. More pixies. Many, many more pixies to drive the big heavy planar magnetics. That said, some of the newer ones from Hi-Fi Man are not particularly difficult to drive, and that's a big plus. And I should say Odyssey Sign series, the on-ear ones they did are fantastically easy to drive.
Excellent.
Assuming you haven't stabbed yourself in the face after the Baton Death podcast. No disrespect to any Baton veterans who may be in the audience or related to anyone in the audience. This was fun. We didn't mean to spend 2 hours talking, but there was a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we could keep going.
Yeah, we could. I've got a pile of stuff here to my right, and I'm just not going to pick it up because I think Robert's going to hit me with something.
Nah, if we missed anything or you want us to expand upon other subjects, you know where to get a hold of us.
Ask at avxl.com, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, at avxl, and communicate with us because we make the show for you, and you make the show possible by donating to patreon.com/avxl. Our next viewer hangout, Patreon hangout, will be taking place. We'll pick a date for that in the next couple of days and get that out to y'all. That's for the people who contribute at the higher levels of Patreon. You can hang out with us virtually in a Google Hangout, pick our brains, and call us rude names if you so desire.
Totally.
Totally.
Or sit there quiet while you're at work, stealth watching.
Yeah, let us know what days you should hold those.
Yeah, date and time. I think we'll leave it up to the audience.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, each and every one of you, for listening. Please send us your questions, your curiosities, the cool stuff you want to share, the hacks you've seen, the awesomeness you covet. And, you know, I'm down with, you know, Volumio on a Raspberry Pi and a decent DAC for $100 total outlay to, well, I guess $150, you know. But we'll get into the whole $3,000 audio streaming device in another show.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.